Are you a parent or caregiver who also loves IBP books? Then we'd love to hear from you. Please go to the link in the show notes and fill out a quick survey to tell us more about your family habits and how IBP can serve you better. You'll be entered to win all the IBP books featured on this season of the podcast. Check the show notes for more information, and thank you for your input.
This episode is brought to you by IVP. Too often, people affected by disabilities are made to feel unwelcome in the church. Pastor Lamar Hardwick is himself on the autism spectrum, and in his book, Disability and the Church, he addresses the church's responsibility to the disabled community. He also affirms God's image in all people and offers practical steps to build truly inclusive faith communities. As a listener of this podcast, you can receive this book for 25% off when you use the promo code IVPOD25, that's IVPOD25, at ivpress.com.
This is IVP.
God has created each of my children with a purpose. And that can get, I think, distorted into the what we were talking about before, the like, okay, so you are supposed to work hard towards your purpose. Because what if you don't maximize your potential, then we are failing God. As opposed to, oh my gosh, like you are so loved that God has a place for you. And that is true for every child. Like that is true for the child with Down syndrome, and it is true for the child with the genius IQ, and it is true for the child who never speaks, and it is true for the child who speaks mile a minute. Like just that sense of, again, not having to conform to a type, but actually to receive each other as we are.
Welcome to Teach Your Children Well, a podcast on parenting in the way of Jesus. I'm Sarah Cowan-Johnson, and here we explore how the biblical story offers wisdom and good news for the 21st century parent. Today, we're going to talk about disability and what it means to reimagine the good life, not only for our children, but also for ourselves. So many of us are caught up and compelled by the cultural vision of success that's shaped by achievement, productivity, appearance, and performance. But what happens when our kids don't fit that mold? Or what happens when we realize that maybe none of us do? Well, my guest today has spent years wrestling with these questions personally, theologically, and as a parent to a child with Down syndrome. Amy Julia Becker writes and speaks on disability, faith, and culture, and that's what I've invited her to do with us today. And whether or not you're raising a child with disability, I want to encourage you, this conversation is actually relevant for all of us because it invites us to see ourselves and our children through a more holistic and healthy lens. Amy Julia is the author of several books. She's the creator of the Reimagining Family Life with Disability Workshop, and she also hosts the Reimagining the Good Life podcast. Amy Julia lives with her husband and their three children in Western Connecticut, and I am so thrilled to have her as my guest today. Well, welcome, Amy Julia, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
So before we dive into the meat of our conversation, I'd really love for our listeners to get to know you a bit. So I'm wondering if you could start by introducing us to your family and sharing just a little bit about what life looks like for the Beckers these days.
Sure. I now have a family with three teenagers, which I actually really love. Three kids. So Penny is our oldest. She's 19 years old. And Penny has Down syndrome, which has certainly shaped our family life in various ways. And then I have a son named William, who is 16, and a daughter, Marilee, who's 14. Penny is out of high school and in a local college program where she goes during the day and takes one class per semester, does some work as part of that program, and learns transition skills. And then William is a junior in high school, so kind of starting some college searching and Yeah, on that track. And Marilee is an eighth grader. So my husband is the head of school at a boarding school. So we live on a campus with 600 high school students.
Wow.
Which might be part of why I enjoy having teenagers, because I've lived with them for most of my adult life. And our son is at boarding school at a different boarding school than where we are, and our youngest daughter will be there as well. So wow. We're a family with lots of different schools in our lives and three teenagers and a lot of joy. We're having a really nice season.
I love that. Yeah, I recently saw you post something on your socials about the joy of parenting teenagers. And I'm like, oh, we are kindred spirits in that, because I love it too. One of the primary ways you describe the work that you do is reimagining the good life, which I love that phrase. And so I wanted to start off by asking if you would share with us, how do you see the dominant cultural narratives describe what the good life is?
Yeah, I was doing some teaching on that idea recently, and I ended up asking people to give me examples under the headings of materialism and moralism. So materialism being, you know, just like having the fancy car or the big house or the just beautiful appearance status markers that are kind of money and success based. And then the moralism being the sense of I'm doing things right, whether that's like I'm eating a keto diet or getting my 10,000 steps, or I'm going to church on Sundays, or I'm giving money away, or I'm, you know, you can kind of fill out that list in lots of different ways. And I do think afterwards I was thinking about it and I was like, I might add one more M to my list of American good life. You know, you've got materialism and moralism, but maybe we've also got merit, like that idea of like hard work, whatever it is you're doing, whether you've got a lot of money or not, whether you've got a lot of goodness or not, you better be working hard at it, because a good life comes from working hard. So those are the things that I think shape our narratives. And we see that a lot. It's pretty easy to see on, you know, social media, the images that we see in advertisements of families, they tend to probably go back to one of those categories or some blend of all of them.
Can you say those M's again, the three M's?
Materialism, moralism, and merit are the three that I'm thinking
moralism,
about.
Merit. As I was thinking about this question, I imagined the first one for sure. And so I love those second and third ones as well. I think that moralism, that's kind of the idea of like being a good person, right?
Yeah, that's sort and of I the... think we do that even when it's not in terms of what we think of as morality. And different people kind of have different moralities, whether that is like, oh my gosh, you must eat organic, or it's important to boycott this store, or, you know, we have different rules around our morality, probably depending on our politics and on our different affiliations with different people, but there's still a sense of rules that govern what is good and bad, telling us what a good life is.
And to the idea of merit, there have been studies of Christian parents that show that the number one concern that parents often have for their kids and thinking about their future is that they would work hard and go to a good school, even above following Jesus, right? So it's like about half of Christian parents list that as a very important future value, but it's close to like 80% that say kids need to work hard. So we can see that in parenting for sure, right?
Yeah,
so,
I didn't know those numbers.
Yeah, it's really striking. It shows us what is our value when we think about preparing our kids to launch into the world. We really want them to work hard and get a good job.
Yeah.
And then hopefully maybe follow Jesus, but that's not quite as important to most of us.
Well, and we also are worried it might get in the way of the first.
Right. Absolutely. Right. That's really true. So in your life, I'm curious, was there ever a time where you sort of felt like you embraced that version of the good life?
Yes. And I would say that there are most days there's some part of me that still embraces any of the above, but whether that, yeah, is the moralism, the materialism, or the merit. That said, I think if I look back to myself in high school, that was probably the epitome of that, in the sense of I was at a really high achieving school and I was a high achiever in that school and I worked really hard and I was like very good. You know, I obeyed the rules. And it was funny, I did not care about my appearance in terms of like makeup and clothing, but I did very much when it came to food and eating and exercise and body image. And so I really am kind of embodied all three of those things as a high school kid. And I would say over time, those got shaped and formed in different ways. Certainly, I would say following Jesus interrupted some of those understandings for me. as did the birth of our daughter Penny, because she did not fit in the categories I had of what it would look like to live a good life.
Wow. Yeah. So I'd love to hear more about that. How has your own imagination about what the good life is, how has that changed?
Yeah. So as I said, I mean, in some ways, like Penny was almost the capstone of the change, in the sense that when I was in high school, as I mentioned, I did end up getting really, really sick. My stomach was paralyzed. And so it was kind of like all of this hard work and body image stuff like kind of came to a terribly logical conclusion, which is that my body shut down. It was like, can't do it. And I was hospitalized.
Wow.
And
wow.
I don't need to go into all the details, but there was really a sense of a need for God and a need for a different way of being that I did not fully embrace, but I was more aware of than I certainly had been ever before. And then, you know, fast forwarding a little bit, early on in my marriage, so when I was 24, 25, something like that, my husband's mother was diagnosed with liver cancer, and we ended up becoming her primary caregivers during her illness. And that rattled my understanding of a good life, because it was like actually this incredibly beautiful experience to walk with her through what amounted to, you know, 6 months up until her death at age 55. So she was not an old woman. And God was so present during that time. There was so much healing. There was so much forgiveness. There was so much joy even and light in the midst of, I mean, physical suffering, as well as just this awareness that this woman who I had just kind of gotten to know and love was going to be gone. So that scrambled my categories of the good life as well. And she was someone who, again, a younger version of me, I would have just felt judgmental towards, because she had not lived the good moral life that I thought she should have. You know, she was a smoker and she had gotten divorced and, you know, these different things. And she was also just this like deeply beautiful, loving person who knew God and God's grace in ways that I did not. So that was an expansion of my, and a challenge, I guess, to my understanding of the good life. But then certainly, and our daughter Penny is named for her. So we call Peter's mom Grand Penny, but our Penny is named for her. What I realized when she was diagnosed with Down syndrome, which for us was after she was born, just a couple hours after she was born, was that I had come into the hospital with a set of expectations about who our child would be. And I felt like I had done the work to deserve the child. Ooh. I expected.
Wow.
You know, like, yeah. I mean, again, this is where the kind of the moralism comes in. I have eaten the right things and I have gone all to all the appointments with the doctor, and I have, you know, abstained from alcohol, and I have whatever you can.
Did the vitamins.
Right. All the right. List of all the things.
Oh, man.
And so there was, again, just like a disruption. And then there was also, looking into the future, this sense of, you know, Penny can work really hard, and she does, and she's not going to achieve the things that America calls the good life. And so maybe, again, that was just like an invitation to ask some questions. And ultimately, this is many years later, I would say my like kind of vision of the good life was reshaped through Jesus's vision, which I think is, again, probably most fully articulated maybe in the Beatitudes, so the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. In fact, some translators even would say you could translate, instead of saying, you know, blessed are the poor in spirit or blessed are the meek, the good life belongs to the poor in spirit. The good life belongs to the meek. And you're like, what are you talking about? But it's meditating on that and really saying, what would it look like to live this way, that has helped to reshape my imagination around the good life.
Wow, that's so beautiful and powerful. And it's interesting, in each of the stories you share, is it's like you've kind of confronted a limitation of some kind. There's a physical limitation in your body, and there's a way that, when we are in these places where we're not able to do, or we're not fulfilling this idea that we have in our minds, that we are confronted with those important questions. So I know when my mom was declining after years with a degenerative neurological disease, watching her suffer and experience limitations in some ways, and yet display the fruit of the spirit so beautifully, was like it is that mind-bending moment of, okay, this doesn't compute with what I think it should be. So as you know, this podcast, our listeners are mostly parents, and we're thinking about how to raise children in the way of Jesus. So I'm wondering, how could we as parents help our kids to reimagine the good life, to use your language there. So could you give us some examples of what is an alternative vision of the good life and how could we help our kids to embrace that?
Yeah. So I guess I kind of go back to those early days with Penny. One being the verse from also the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus says, be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. And I knew that that couldn't mean what it kind of sounded like face value for me. But what I learned, you know, I looked up perfect in the English dictionary. And one of the definitions, which was kind of my understanding, was conforming absolutely to an ideal type. And A, I knew that that had not worked in my own life. And B, I knew that had not worked in my daughter's life. Like we had already failed, like we were not. But I also learned that the word in Greek for perfect is actually telos. And that word means like the end for which you are created. So that thought of like, be who you are created to be as God is who God is, like in the fullness of being, was really freeing and like a beautiful invitation, not only to me as a human personally, but also as a parent. That sense of like, God has created each of my children with a purpose. And that can get, I think, distorted into the what we were talking about before, the like, okay, so you are supposed to work hard towards your purpose. Because if you don't maximize your potential, then we are failing God. As opposed to, oh my gosh, like you are so loved that God has a place for you. And that is true for every child. Like that is true for the child with Down syndrome. And it is true for the child with the genius IQ. And it is true for the child who never speaks. And it is true for the child who speaks a mile a minute. Like just that sense of, again, not having to conform to a type, but actually to receive each other as we are. So that was a big paradigm shift for me. And then the other thing that happened early on in Penny's life that has really shaped my parenting in a way that I think has to do with reimagining the good life is the idea of belovedness and having a desire for me and my children, like all of us, to understand ourselves as beloved ones first and foremost. And so purpose comes out of that. Abilities come out of that. Like everything else comes out of that, not the other way around. Not like, hey, you're so good at this, that means you're loved. But actually, you are so loved, we can explore what you love. And you might be good at it, you might not, but like that, it's just, I think, gives a lot of freedom. We heard early on someone who talked, especially in the realm of disability, about how it's very easy for parents and children to get in a really negative feedback loop about any sort of skill training. Because what comes, you know, you have therapists come in, they tell you, okay, your child has low muscle tone, and therefore these are the deficits, and we need to start working on strengthening those weak areas. And so you try to strengthen the weak area, which means that your child is like working really hard, but in a frustrating way. And you probably as a parent are feeling like, I'm not serving you well, like I'm not getting anywhere. And so I'm frowning at you, you're frowning at me, and we're like spiraling downward. And so we heard really early on just this idea of responsive parenting, of actually looking for the places where your child delights in something, delighting in that with them. Like, and so in Penny's case, that was reading books. She just always loved books. And it's like, gosh, books are actually great for fine motor skills. Like you have to flip pages. And so what if she doesn't want to work on stacking blocks? We can actually be working on fine motor skills, but in this way that actually brings delight and like a smile to my face and to hers. Which obviously books have speech. I mean, there are all sorts of things that come from books. But the same is true if you have a kid who really is interested in balls and not at all in books, that you can say, okay, great, let's take delight in this together. So that sense of belovedness and delight also feels to me like a reimagined good life. And then the final thing I'll say is I do think that a reimagined good life makes space for suffering, space for mystery. And that's not true in like the American version of the good life. And so that is the other piece, even in terms of just teaching our children that it's not always going to go the way you expect. And sometimes you work really hard and like actually making mistakes and sometimes failing at things, like that's a part of the good life because of how we're being trained up and the ways that God actually enters into our experience is often in those times of need and of even of pain. So that is the other piece that I would put into the mix.
Oh, that's really good. I spent a long time working with InterVarsity with college students at a pretty elite school and a lot of privileged kids who hadn't had extreme experiences of suffering until, you know, often it was like the loss of a grandparent was the first time they're really wrestling with grief and sorrow and pain. And I watched so many college students just really at that moment begin to question God's goodness. Yeah. And I kind of made a commitment as I'm raising my kids. I want them to know that God is present with them on the high moments and in the low moments. Yeah. So we do this practice. We've done it since they were, as soon as they were verbal, every night before bed, we do a version of the examen. So it's, you know, typically that's where have you sensed God's presence or missed God's presence? But to a little kid, it's where were you happy today? Where were you sad today? And who was with you all day long? Because I feel like somehow we have in the Western church and sort of what you're getting at, like we have taught our kids that God is present in the highs, but where is he in the lows? And I think it's really important to reimagine that, God is present in the highs and the lows. And,
totally.
So I love that. So I'd love to dive a little deeper into some of the cultural narratives around disability specifically.
Sure.
So what messages are families picking up today from the culture around them? And that could be both helpful and unhelpful messages.
Yeah. So one thing I've seen that's changed over the course of Penny's lifetime when it comes to actually the helpful messages, largely I see coming through social media. And it's funny because I have lots to say that is not positive about social media, especially as the parent of teenagers. And yet it shapes the imagination of our culture when it comes to families with affected by disability. And that's true, whether it has to do with Down syndrome or autism or cerebral palsy or, you know, all sorts of conditions and diagnoses, and seeing those not only in a medical context, but actually in the primary context, which is family life. That's where most of us grow up and spend our days, and being able to look at families who are, again, struggling sometimes and suffering sometimes and experiencing tremendous joy and connection and love throughout that time, I think is really beautiful and portrays a lot that is like really helpful about disability. So that's where I'm seeing helpful messages. On the unhelpful side, I think we still as a culture see disability as a problem to be fixed, and sometimes even as like a tragedy to be eradicated. And so we see that in these like really extreme ways, whether we're talking about like the termination of a pregnancy or euthanasia of disabled people. We also see it in much more benign ways. Like I remember this was early on in Penny's life. I was at a birthday party. I was there with Penny. There was another mom there with another girl who clearly had a disability of some sort. And the only question I could think to ask this mom, which I did not ask, was, "What's wrong with your daughter?" Which clearly I was like, I would never want someone to say that to me. And it's all I can think of to say. And so I missed out on what I think could have been a really sweet conversation with this mom. And all I needed to say was, "Tell me about your daughter."
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What do you and your daughter love to do together? What's hard? Right. There were so many questions, which I later, of course, like filled in the gap for myself. But it showed me again, just that I had inherited this message of like disability is a problem. And so I'm seeing your daughter as a problem instead of as just the fullness of who she is, which involves, I'm sure, some hard things and some good things, because isn't that true of children? So yeah, disability is like a problem, a tragedy. The other thing we still see is disability as like an insult or a joke. And so that is something that, you know, comes out through language and many, many comics as well as comedy like shows. And the last thing that I'm going to say that sounds a little bit strange sometimes is disability as an inspiration can be an unhelpful message, because two things can happen. We can see the person with a disability as existing for our benefit, like you are kind of here as a prop to inspire me. And we can also essentially say, unless your life is filled with inspiration, it's not worth living, as opposed to, again, that fullness of humanity, where, of course, people with disabilities have inspiring moments and opportunities and stories to tell. It's not to take that away. But when they get reduced to that, I think it reduces their humanity in a hard way.
That makes sense that, you know, in the world around us, every culture reflects certain certain ways it reflects the image of God, and other ways it's broken. And so we can see, there's some things that are helpful, some things that are harmful. Best known for her insightful and poignant reflections on faith and life, Kathleen Nora steps into uncharted territory by sharing an intimate memoir exploring her deeply personal relationships. In her book, Rebecca Sue, Norris offers a tender tribute to her younger sister, Becky, who was born with perinatal hypoxia. Becky's life was shaped by physical and mental disabilities, yet her spirit and resilience illuminate the hidden power of faith, family, and love. Through Becky's story, Norris examines the myriad ways God works in our lives, both seen and unseen. Stay tuned until the end of the episode to find out how you can get a special discount on Rebecca Sue at ivypress.com. So I'm curious if we could shift our attention to the church for a moment. And I'd actually be curious, because we will talk about the biblical narrative in a minute, but could you share any unhelpful or false narratives about disability that you and your family have encountered within the church? So what parts of Christian theology or praxis around disability need to be reimagined?
I remember, so when Penny was first born, I was in seminary. And so I'm lying in the hospital, having been told that I have a baby with Down syndrome. And I mean, even in the hospital room, said out loud, I'm just trying to understand, is Down syndrome a manifestation of the fall? Like, is this purely about brokenness, in the language I would have used? And I didn't mean by that, is Penny sinful in some way that I'm not? I just meant, like, if all of creation is broken, is that what's happening here? And my mom was there, and she said, you know, the only evidence of sin that I see in Penny's birth is in how we respond to her. And it was this beautiful moment of saying, okay, maybe there's like more going on here than I understand. Later, many years later, I read a book by a theologian called Brian Brock, who also has a son with Down syndrome, who has a dual diagnosis of Down syndrome and autism. And he wrote a book called Wondrously Wounded, talking about how the early church really understood children with visible disabilities as wonders of creation. They might not understand like what, where, but they also trusted that God, as a good creator, was bringing things we don't understand to our attention through these beautiful and created humans. And it wasn't, again, Augustine obviously believed in sin, but there was a sense of, I think for me, what I was doing really early on, and I think a lot of people do this, was thinking that brokenness and limitations are the same thing, when actually limits are a part of our good humanity. They're something that God has actually given to us so that we develop a sense of community, of need for God, for one another. We learn how to love each other. We learn how to love ourselves in our limitedness. We see Jesus as the ideal human who has very clear limits, you know. And I was thinking really wrongly about that. And I think I got that from the church. So that's like the first thing about theological messages, is kind of seeing disability as evil or sinful or broken. And I've just last week was sitting with a woman whose mother was like, I rebuke this Down syndrome in the name of Jesus, about her granddaughter. And the woman was like, no, mom, we're going to receive her in all of who she is. And that includes Down syndrome. That's one place. The other place is actually similar to the inspiration idea. John chapter 9 actually is probably the best example I know of in scripture of this, where the disciples see a man who's been born blind. And they say, first they say, who sinned, this man or his parents? So you kind of see that first problem. But they also are completely objectifying him. Like, they just make him into a theological lesson for them instead of seeing him as like a full human. And Jesus goes on to say, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but this happened so that the glory of God might be revealed. And there's a sense in which, like, he is already revealing God's glory, back to this idea of the wonders of creation. And he is a full human, not a lesson for your edification. And so Jesus then goes and interacts with this man in a very personal way and demonstrates the humanity. But I think that's still something where, when we in our churches set up positions where people with disabilities need our love, attention, care, charity, but are not in relationships of mutual giving and receiving, in which we recognize, yeah, what they have to offer as a part of the purpose that God has given them, then we can, yeah, reduce them to like a lesson or an object of pity.
I'm really struck. I'm still just thinking about that idea of, is this a result of the fall? Is Down syndrome a result of the fall? Have you ever asked or answered the question, how does Down syndrome, or how does Penny's Down syndrome in particular, image God?
I love that question. I think, one, as you said, there is a particularity that is important, because Down syndrome, as with most disabilities, presents so differently from person to person. There are some general things. Many people with Down syndrome move more slowly through the world. That is true of Penny. And one of the things that comes up a lot in kind of theology of disability is the idea that Jesus also moved slowly through the world, like the 3-mile-per-hour God. And John Swinton is a disability theologian who has said, like, yeah, love moves at the pace of approximately 3 miles per hour. Like, it's slow. And you think about 1 Corinthians 13, like, love is patient. And I just remember one time when Penny was away at a camp and she was writing down things that she valued. And one of the things she said was not rushing. And I thought, you know, for most of my life, I've seen Penny's slowness as the problem. And for most of her life, she has seen her family quickness as the problem, and she might be right. Like, you know, so there is a sense of, like, again, that's both particular to Penny, but maybe it is also more broadly true of many people with Down syndrome. And there are lots of things like that. One of the things, we go to a camp in the summer that's called Hope Heals, and it's people with disabilities of all sorts. There are like 70 something diagnoses at camp and all different age groups. But one of the things that a friend of mine said from after being at camp was, like, there's no ego there. Like, there's just a sense of, yeah, really being humans together and not setting up like a new status system. And that, I think, is another way in which there's, yeah, a taste of heaven for sure in not just being with Penny, but my experience with a lot of people with disabilities and probably intellectual disabilities in particular.
Wow. Yeah. I know, you know, as someone who I am always wrestling my ego and my vanity, you know, watching my mom handle her lack of mobility, lack of being able to speak with really almost no visible ego or vanity was so inspiring and moving for me in a big fat mirror, like, oh wow, it's not how I would probably respond. So it's beautiful. So I'd love to talk about the biblical narrative. So we've sort of talked about cultural narratives, some unhelpful narratives in the church. How does the biblical story challenge or correct some of the false narratives that we've been talking about?
You know, for a long time, I wasn't really sure that it did. I was a little nervous about that. I mean, John 9, again, came up really early that I've already mentioned in Penny's life. And I could see that Jesus was kind of complicating this story of disability. But at the same time, you know, Jesus heals people all the time. And many people, if you were to talk to with disabilities, would say, no, you don't need to pray for my healing, or at least not in the way you think I need to be healed. Like, I have a friend named Catherine Wolf, who's the co-founder of Hope Heals. She uses a wheelchair. And she's like, no, pray for my quick temper with my children. That's where I need healing. You don't need to pray about my face. Like, you know, so I think there's some significance in recognizing the healing stories in the Bible actually are much more complicated than they might first appear. I did a lot of writing around this in my book, To Be Made Well, but the very short version of it would be to say that Jesus's primary concern is reconnecting people to God, to themselves, and to their communities. And there are certainly ways in which having a physical experience of healing is a part of that, but that is very much incomplete, if not, and insufficient when it comes to healing for Jesus. And then what I learned much later on, partially through the work of Amy Kenney, who wrote a book called My Body is Not a Prayer Request. She is also someone who uses a wheelchair and is a professor. And one of the things that she alerted me to was, so like, if we think about the story of Jacob, for example, who wrestles with God, and it is in that wrestling that he receives a blessing and a new name, kind of for the first time. He's been trying to steal the blessing all along. He's been trying to like finagle his way. But here he receives a blessing and at the same time receives like his hip being pushed out of joint. So he limps for the rest of his life. And that is a constant reminder and sign of God's blessing on his life. So like his disability is literally like enmeshed in his blessing. I sometimes wonder whether the same is true with Paul's eyesight. We have this story of Paul being blinded on the road to Damascus and then scales falling from his eyes. And he writes about not being able to see very well, right? That's something we know. And I just wonder whether that is this constant reminder of this initial encounter with Jesus that changed his life. And again, whether his like disabling condition is actually a reminder from God of like, I'm with you. Always exactly what you were saying you say to your children. You know, those are some complicating narratives for me in a good way, like in a, oh, okay, I need to think about this differently. And then there's also a story in Luke 14, which listeners might be familiar with. Jesus kind of tells it twice. Like he's going to dinner at a prominent Pharisee's house on a Sabbath day. And he says to everybody, you're sitting in the wrong places. You shouldn't be trying to seat yourselves according to status. And in fact, he tells the host, you invited all the wrong people. You shouldn't have invited the people like us. You should have invited the lame, the poor, the blind. And then he tells a parable and kind of says it again, where he says, this is what the kingdom of heaven is like. It's like a wedding feast where the people, all these people say no, they're not going to come to the wedding feast. And then the host invites the lame, the poor, the blind, and they kind of come running to the table. And what's interesting is they come running to the table as they are. So it's a picture of like kind of the wedding feast of the kingdom of God, the pinnacle of a heavenly banquet. And the first people to the table are the disabled people, literally in the bodies that they have. And then Jesus goes on to say that the host goes out and invites everybody else to come in. So it's not as though there's no room for anyone else, but it's also not as though everyone goes through some like healing machine as they walk through the door. Again, it's a vision. It's a parable. We don't expect, we shouldn't do too much with it, but I think it's pretty suggestive in terms of what Jesus is paying attention to in terms of who we are and who we are, what it means for us to be becoming perfect in that telos sense, becoming who we are created to be. We focus more on our bodies than I think Jesus does, and less, quite frankly, on our relationships and on our hearts and on our care for others in this world.
Thank you. That's beautiful. So something you talk about pretty often is why disability matters to all of us, not just to those who are directly affected. So could you share some thoughts about that with us?
Yes, absolutely. You mentioned earlier with your mom that it was like a big fat mirror in front of you where you were like, ah. And it's funny you say that because we say all the time that disability is a magnifying glass on our common humanity, where I'm like, oh, okay. It's not just with Penny that I confuse brokenness and limitations. It's with myself as well. Like I've learned how to be so much more gracious with myself because I'm like, no, it was not like sinful that you dropped the bag or that you lost the watch or whatever. You know, it's like that was just you being a limited human who makes mistakes sometimes, you know. So there is that sense of just, again, like a magnifying glass on my humanity. The other thing I've been thinking about a lot recently related to this is that I think all of us as humans have limits and possibilities. And when we overemphasize or only emphasize one or the other of those, it becomes dehumanizing. So for people with disabilities, there's often this total overemphasis of limits. And we've talked about that already here, whether that becomes like, oh, you're my object of pity because all I see is your limits, instead of recognizing your gifts and possibilities. But I think the opposite is true too. And so, I mean, I mentioned I live on a boarding school campus. My kids are in these like high achieving schools. I was one of those kids. And I think in those contexts, we overemphasize the possibilities. And we fail to recognize the limitedness of our humanity, our need for each other, to give space for vulnerability, making mistakes, just like needing to get some sleep or like needing to take care of yourself. I mean, again, there's so much. I have many friends who are like, yeah, no, like my kids aren't going to do their laundry. They don't have time for that. And it's like, but maybe they need to have time for that, like both for the actual process of doing some things that's with their bodies and not their brains, but also in that sense of like, yeah, part of what's important in your life is caring for yourself. And you don't have to be like striving towards your potential at all times, because I think that's actually quite crushing. The last thing I would say is, and I think this is related, I really did not have an understanding of belovedness as like core to my identity as being one who is like in Christ. Like I didn't understand that. So having Penny and recognizing her as one who is like loved by God. And I guess once I realized that like, if anything is true about her as a human, it's also true about me. I was like, wait, really? Really? Like, I don't have to. And I know, I mean, I've heard 700 sermons on how I don't have to earn God's love, but really deep down, understanding belovedness, I think is like world changing in terms of who we become. So those are just some thoughts on like why it matters that we understand disability. In fact, I mean, very much so for those of us who have not yet encountered disability in our bodies or minds, because it'll come someday.
Could you share, just as you, you know, think about those particular ideas, what would that look like to sort of weave some of those ideas into our parenting? So what do kids, either with disability or without, need to understand about why this matters?
Yeah. So for me, like language has really been helpful to consider in this. So with our kids, I've really emphasized, we talk about disability. We've never shied away from saying Penny has a disability or Down syndrome or, you know, those that So I try to use language that's like normalized and neutralized, you know, where it's not judgment based, but just statements of fact. But also, again, I think that can lead into this problem of setting up a hierarchy. And what I want them to understand is that common humanity without pretending that like we're not different from each other. And so we use the language of challenges and gifts in our family in terms of like, yeah, that seems like that's really challenging for you. Or here's a gift that you bring into our family or into the world in various ways. And I think that sets up basically a posture of mutuality. It's not a posture of transaction because it's not like it aligns in such a way that, you know, I pay you $10 and you give me the thing that's worth $10. Like that's, it's not like that. But there is a sense of almost trusting that each of us has something to give and each of us has something to receive from one another. But it's like we have to have almost a faith that that's true, especially in people who are not as valued by our wider culture. It can take longer to recognize that. The story I told about Penny and slowing down is a good example because our culture values moving quickly and getting things done. And yet a slow walk with Penny, I think for many people would actually be like a pretty healing opportunity just to like walk slowly with someone who is going to actually be interested in who you are and not what you can accomplish for her. But So anyway, back to your original question, I do think that sense of like mutuality and talking in terms of and understanding ourselves in terms of challenges and gifts or limits and possibilities, you know, any of those types of words can be really helpful.
Yeah, no, it is really helpful. It reminds me of a framework that we use with our kids that my parents used with us, which is of the difference between blessing and praise, where praise is about things you can do. So praise would be like, you're such a good artist, like that you made a beautiful painting, where blessing, it describes a way you image God. So you are so creative. You know, and it's a subtle shift, yeah. But it's your language of gifts and calling out gifts really is blessing language. Yeah. And it's different from praise because really it goes to who we are and how God's made us. So I love that. Well, in each episode, we invite our guests to respond to a listener question. So here is a question for you today.
What would you say to a parent who wants to raise their young kids to be sensitive, aware, and loving toward people with disabilities, but feels awkward and unsure of how to have these conversations? The parent might feel unfamiliar with which terms to use and are worried they will say something wrong. Do you have any tips for what to say or not to say?
I think the first thing to know is that most people feel that way, and that includes parents of children with disabilities. I felt so awkward as a young mom of a child with Down syndrome. I still, when I meet people who have diagnoses where I'm either not familiar with them, I want to speak about this the way you want to, but I'm not sure. And, you know, even to this day, there are parents who feel really strongly that their child is a child with autism and others who feel really strongly that they have an autistic child. So it's like literally you can't get it right. You have to actually say, how would you like me to refer to your child's diagnosis? Do you see that in kind of identity terms or do you see it in diagnostic? Like, how do you see it? I want to be respectful. And I think that type of honesty is actually a great starting point. So there's a humility there. And generally, you're going to find an understanding listener on the other side. One of the things I've said before is that, like, if you take one step towards a family with a disability, you'll probably find they're willing to take 10 steps in return, because I think there's so much fear in this area and it ends up meaning that we as families can be so alienated. You know, we're not going to get it all right, and that's okay. I have messed up before. I've had people mess up with me. Coming back and saying, I think I messed up. I'm really sorry. I mean, again, it does it all. So I do think that heart of wanting, the heart posture matters more than getting it all right. And you can get a lot of things right by being humbly curious and taking this next step.
Thank you, Amy Julia. You can find Amy Julia's books wherever books are sold. And you can learn more about her and her work at amyjuliabecker.com. So Amy Julia, would you pray for us as we close?
Sure. Oh, Lord, thank you so much for just being present with us in this conversation. And I pray especially for the families, parents who are listening right now, both those who have experiences of disability in their family and those who are like just wondering what it would mean to encounter other children or families with disability with your heart of love, but not pity, looking for possibilities and having compassion in the midst of limitations. Help us all to be ones who love like you love and see like you see and do as you do. And we pray these things in your name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you. And now it's time for Steal This Idea, a simple, practical way to take today's conversation and live it out at home. Try it, tweak it, make it your own. The goal isn't to replicate exactly what I do with my family, but to practice the beautifully distinct and compelling way of Jesus with yours. In the Becker family, they talk openly about disability, and they use the language of gifts and challenges, not just for their daughter Penny, but for everyone. This language helps them to recognize that every person, regardless of ability, has something to offer and something to receive. This is true of every child, every parent, every human being. So here's the idea. It's really simple. Set aside a moment in your day, maybe around the dinner table, maybe at bedtime, maybe during a longer car ride, and invite each family member to name two things: one gift they see in someone else and one challenge they're facing. It probably helps if you, as the parent, go first to model. But once everyone has shared, you can close in prayer, thanking God for his good gifts and inviting his help with the challenges that the family is facing. This practice helps kids grow in empathy, confidence, and self-awareness. And it reinforces that they are deeply loved, not because of what they can do, but because of who they are. And it also makes room for both strength and struggle in family life. So this practice obviously works best with older kids who can engage in conversation, but you can model this even with very young kids by using the language of gifts and challenges regularly around them. So I hope you'll give this a try. The Teach Your Children Well podcast is a production of InterVarsity Press. For more information on any IVP titles mentioned in this episode, visit ivpress.com and use code IVPTEACH25. That's IVPTEACH25 for 25% off and free U.S. shipping. Sound engineering by Honest Podcasts. Our producers are Helen Lee, Caitlin Borick, and Travis Albritton. I'm your host, Sarah Cowan Johnson. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the IVP YouTube channel, and leave a rating and review to support the show.